Osho, the first principle, talks on Zen, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. Beloved Bhagwan, it seems to me that I don't understand anything that's far out with there. If it is really true, then it is great. If you don't understand anything, then the door is open. Then there is nothing to hinder your way, to hinder your vision. It is knowledge that is obstructing. Ignorance is an opening. Ignorance is very blissful. It is knowledge that creates noise. It is knowledge that does not allow you to see. If your eyes are completely rid of knowledge, then what is there to hinder you from seeing the truth? The truth is obvious. Just you need a clarity to see it. Ignorance gives that clarity. To be consciously ignorant is to be in Satori. A child is ignorant but not conscious of his ignorance. A saint is ignorant but is conscious of his ignorance. He knows that he knows not. That's the only difference. The child also knows not, but he does not know. The saint knows that he knows not. His whole knowledge consists of one single thing, that there is nothing to be known, and there is no possibility to know, that the whole effort towards knowledge is futile, that existence is such a mystery that it can never be reduced to knowledge. All that we know is superficial, arbitrary. All that we know has nothing to do with reality. The reality remains untouched by our knowledge. The reality remains mysterious. If it is really true that you have become aware of your ignorance, then there is nothing else to be sought, nothing else to attain. Relax in this ignorance. Accept this ignorance and feel blissful. But it may not be true. That's why I say, if it is true. It may be again just a hankering to know. Then you have not understood. Then you are not at ease with your non-knowing. The question seems to be that you are worried. Otherwise, why question? You are worried. Something is gnawing your heart. You are worried that I don't understand anything and I have to understand. In fact, when Vidya had come, she must have thought that she knows. Now by and by, I have been hammering on her and her knowledge has disappeared. Now she is worried. When you come to me, you come full of knowledge. You come with much luggage, and that luggage has to be destroyed, burnt utterly, so that you cannot find it again. When you lose your luggage, you start feeling as if you are missing something. Naturally so. So long you have been carrying the load. Now suddenly it is gone. You feel you are missing something. The question has arisen because of you, your feeling that something is being missed. I don't know anything. The knowledge has disappeared and ignorance has not yet been accepted. If you don't accept ignorance, sooner or later you will gain to knowledge again. You will start gathering and holding. And this time you will hold in a more subtler way, so that it cannot be taken easily away from you. Beware. These are the moments when you need a master to say to you that accept and relax into this ignorance. I am not here to impart you knowledge. I am here to take it away from you. In one of the most ancient books in India, Shiva Sutra, there is a tremendously significant sutra. Jnanam Bandham. Knowledge is bondage. When there is no knowledge, a man is free. It is such a radical statement. All knowledge is bondage. The moment you know that you don't know, the bondage falls. But if you have lived in the bondage for long, you start accepting it as part of you. If a man has lived in the prison for many years with chains on his hands and on his feet, then suddenly take away the chains. He will not be able even to sleep in the night. He has become accustomed. He needs that weight, that noise. When you used to turn in the night, those chains used to make noise. Now suddenly the noise will not be there. He will become awake again and again in the night. Something is missing. Walking, he will feel as if he is naked. Something is missing. He has become accustomed with that weight. And that's how everybody has become accustomed with the weight of knowledge. Knowledge is a bondage. The question arises only because the acceptance has not arisen yet. You can miss this great opportunity of being ignorant. Relax. Love it. Embrace it. Feel one with it. And there will arise a new sort of innocence. You were innocent when you were a child. This will be a new birth and a new sort of innocence. Again you will become a child, and yet your childlike quality will not be childish. It will have a maturity in it. Sometimes reading, sometimes listening, and particularly listening to Zen, you may start feeling, I don't know anything. Because the Zen people are very much against knowledge. You may start clinging to the idea of not knowing. But that idea is not going to help. That idea is again part of knowledge. Listening to the Zen masters, you may start getting attached to the very idea of not knowing. Then this idea of not knowing becomes your knowledge. To be really in deep ignorance means you don't have even the idea of non-knowledge. You are simply innocent. The knowledge has disappeared and nothing has appeared in its place. Let me tell you this famous anecdote. Traditionally, Zen monasteries will only admit wandering Zen monks if they can show proof of having solved a koan. And you can solve a koan only when you have fallen into deep ignorance, not before it. Because a koan is not a puzzle. Or if it is a puzzle, then it is not an ordinary puzzle. An ordinary puzzle can be solved by the mind. If you put your mind to it, you can find a way to solve it. It has a solution. A koan is such a puzzle that it has no mind solution possible. You cannot solve it. It is not a question what you do. It is insoluble. Mind cannot give any answer to it. For example, Zen masters say, listen to the one hand clapping. Listen to the sound of one hand clapping. Now one hand cannot clap. And unless it claps, there will not be any sound. So what you are going to listen? The mind will work out many solutions and all will be meaningless. And the master will send you back again and again, again. Listen. Meditate. The solution will happen one day when the mind disappears. When you work hard with the mind and the mind finds no way to reach to any solution. Out of sheer tiredness, the mind falls flat on the ground. Suddenly you are in a state of no mind and you hear the sound of one hand clapping. The mind hears only the sound of two hands clapping because the mind lives in duality. The mind can hear only a created sound. When the mind disappears, you hear the soundless sound, what the Hindus call anahat nath. The word anahat means exactly the same word Zen people call the sound of one hand clapping. If you clash two things, there is a sound that is called ahatanad, a sound that comes out of conflicts. And there is a sound permeating existence itself, which is not created, uncreated. When you become so silent that the mind has disappeared with all its noise, suddenly that soundless sound is heard. That Omkar, that Anahat Nath is heard. But that happens only when the mind has gone. Traditionally, Zen monasteries will only admit wandering Zen monks if they can show proof of having solved a koan. It seems that a monk once knocked on a monastery gate. The monk who opened the gate did not say hello or good morning, but show me your original face, the face you had before your father and mother were born. This is a koan. And the host is asking the guest to show some sign that he can solve a koan, otherwise he is not worthy of being allowed to stay in the monastery, then he will have to go away. The monk who wanted a room for the night smiled, pulled a sandal off his foot and hit his questioner in the face with it. The other monk stepped back, bowed respectfully and bade the visitor welcome. After dinner, host and guest started a conversation and the host complimented his guest on his splendid answer. Do you yourself know the answer to the koan you gave me? The guest asked. No, answered the host, but I knew that your answer was right. You did not hesitate for a moment. It came out quite spontaneously. It agreed exactly with everything I have heard or read about Zen. The guest did not say anything and sipped his tea. Suddenly the host became suspicious. There was something in the face of his guest which he did not like. "You do know the answer, don't you?" he asked. The guest began to laugh and finally rolled over the mat with mirth. "No, reverend brother," he said, "but I too have read a lot and heard a lot about Zen." Hearing to me, many things you will start imagining. Many things you will start believing. Beware, because those things won't help. Hearing Zen, reading Zen, is not going to give you Zen. Zen is a quality that you have to attain to. It is a new vision of life and reality. It is a new penetration into the mystery of existence. It is not intellectual. It is existential. You have to throb with it. Your heart has to beat with it. You have to breathe in and out. It is not going to be just an intellectual understanding. Listening to me, the understanding will come to you intellectually very easily. Because whatsoever I am saying is simple. There is nothing difficult about it. It is not very complex. I am not spinning any philosophical theories here. I am simply stating simple facts. Now this fact is simple, that a child has an innocent clarity. And one day, if you also attain consciously to that childhood, what Jesus calls when you are reborn, that is the rebirth, then you will be able to see what is. But listening to me, you may start thinking that, yes, that's right, I also don't know anything. But is it your understanding? Or just a reflection of my understanding? Is it your experience or just an imitation? It happens. In the presence of every master it happens. Because man is naturally imitative. Darwin is right. Man comes from the monkeys and is very imitative. He can imitate anything. I have heard there was a great master. The master would sit for hours alone in his cave meditating, his only companion being a favorite cat which he tied to a post in his cave during his periods of meditation. As years went by, his fame spread, and he soon had a number of pupils who came to learn from him and who made him their guru or their master. He instructed his pupils to meditate as he did. Soon each pupil could be observed meditating with a cat tied to a post by his side. The master died. So what the pupils did, they had known always one cat being tied by the side of the master with a post. Naturally, they thought the cat must have something to do with meditation. And cats are very esoteric people. The cat must have something to do with meditative energy. Somehow the cat must have been a help. Otherwise, why? The master used to do it continuously. For years they had seen it. Whenever he was meditating, the cat was there tied to the post. He had to tie the cat, otherwise the cat will disturb his meditation. The cat may jump into his lap, would like to play with him. Cats don't bother whether you are meditating or not. So the cat has to be tied to the post. But what about the disciples? They watched. And you can see only the outwards. The inner remains invisible. Naturally, they also try to imitate it. It happens. Beware that too. Beware of that too. Don't be imitative. Just because I am saying something, you need not repeat it. If you repeat it, it will be not helpful for your own growing understanding. Don't repeat it. Let it sink into your being. Experience it. If I say something, there is no need to believe in it. There is no need to disbelieve either. Remain open. If I say something, then try it. Then look at the trees without any ideas, whatever. Look at the birds and the sky with no knowledge. Drop language and see what I am saying, whether it gives you clarity. If you can drop the word rose and then see the flower rose, what happens? You will immediately feel a new kind of relationship arising between you and the flower. Don't call it even a flower. There is no need. Your language is not needed to support it. It exists without language. Why bring language in? You put language aside. You put your continuous gibberish that goes on inside the mind. Just look. In the beginning it is difficult. The language will come up again and again, just out of old habit. But sooner or later, it comes easily. You can remain at least for few moments without language, listening to the song of the birds or the murmurs of the wind passing through the trees or the river. You can remain for few seconds, and in those seconds will be the proof of what I have been saying to you. Suddenly you will see as if a great darkness has disappeared and everywhere is light. You can see as if the doors of perception has been cleansed. Ordinarily we are seeing through dark curtains. The glass we are seeing through is too dusty. Only fragments of reality appear, not the totality. Experience what I am saying, don't imitate. And then, this is going to happen to you one day, you will certainly see you don't know anything. But this will be a vision, a realization. Then it is great. If it is truly happening, it is great. Second question. Meher Baba has talked about God descending in man, Avatara, Rasul, Christ, and man rising to be God, the perfect master, Sadguru, Kurtub, Tirthankara. Would you please talk to us about the same? God is. He neither ascends nor descends. Where he can ascend and where he can descend. God is all. There is nothing in which God can ascend or descend. There is nobody else than God. All that is divine. So the first thing, there is no ascendance, no descendance. But when Meher Baba says it, there must be some meaning in it. The meaning is something quite different. Let me explain it to you. God is, remember, God is a pure isness, pure existence. and there is nowhere for God to go or come. The whole is full of Him. He fills His existence. One thing. Second thing, but Meher Baba must be true. Then there must be some other meaning to it. Not God descending and ascending. What can be the meaning? The meaning is, there are two ways of man approaching to God. What do I mean by man? When God is the only reality. Man is the God who has forgotten that he is a God. Man is a God who has forgotten himself. Man can remember his godliness in two ways. One way is that of surrender, devotion, love, prayer. Another way is that of will, effort, meditation, yoga. If a man tries to work his way through will, then he will feel he is ascending towards God, or he is reaching towards God through his will. Hence Jainas call the man who attains to godliness Tirthankara. Tirthankara means consciousness has reached the peak. Man has arrived by ascending. As if there has been a ladder, the ladder of the will, the ladder of effort and yoga. So is the concept of the Buddhas. That too is the path of will. Avatara means God descending. That is another approach. When a man surrenders, he cannot ascend. He simply opens his heart and waits, prays and waits. And suddenly he starts feeling a stirring in his heart. Certainly he will say, God has descended in me. Avatara means descendence. God coming down. Mahavira went up. For Meera, God came down. But God never comes down, never goes up. God is where He is. But your experience will be different. If you try hard to achieve to God, you will go higher and higher and higher. Naturally, you will feel the God hidden inside you is arising, rising up, reaching to the zenith. But if you surrender, nothing is arising in you. You are where you are. You simply wait in deep prayer, in deep love, in deep trust. And one day you find God is descending in you. Coming from above. These are the experiences of two types of seekers. It has nothing to do with God. It has something to do with the seeker and his way. Will or surrender. Effort or prayer. Yoga or bhakti. So the religions which believe in bhakti, in devotion, Christianity, says Christ comes from God. That is the meaning that He is God's Son. He comes from above. He has been sent. And that is the meaning of Muhammad. He is a prophet, a messenger, Peygamber. Peygamber means a messenger who comes from above, brings the message. He does not belong to this world. He comes like a ray of light into the darkness. And so is the concept of the Hindus' avatara. Krishna, Rama, they come. they come into the world.
The Buddhist, the Jainist concept is just the reverse. They say there is no God to come. And God is not a father and he cannot have a son. These are all very childish concepts for them. And if you look through their eyes, they are. These concepts are childish. Very anthropomorphic. Man-centered. You create God in your own image. As if God has also a family. He has a family. The Trinity. God the Father, Christ the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost must be a woman. Otherwise the family will not be exactly as it should be. But why Christians don't call the Holy Ghost a woman? Male chauvinism. They cannot make a woman also part of Trinity. It is difficult for them, very difficult for them. So what they have reduced their gods, it seems to be a homosexual family. All men, not a single woman there. It looks ugly. But my feeling is that Holy Ghost must be a woman. But we create God in our own image. Jains and Buddhas say that there is no God and there is no God's family and nobody comes from there. Then what one has to do? One has to arise. God is in you like a seed, as a tree arises from the earth, goes higher and higher. God is not like rain falling, but a tree arising. Man has the seed. Man is potentially God. So when you work hard, you start growing. These are the two concepts. That's why Meher Baba says, God descending in man, avatar, Rasul, Christ, and God, man rising to be God, the perfect master, Sadguru, Kutub, Tirthankara. But it has nothing to do with God. The third question. When I was a child, I was inoculated against the measles. Can I still catch them now? Yes, every child has been inoculated. Every child has been destroyed. Every child has been conditioned in such a way that he cannot get the measles I am talking about. You have been brought up as a Christian or a Hindu. That very bringing up closes your doors. Even if Christ comes to you, you will not be able to see him. The idea that Christianity has given to you about Christ is so false. It is so foolish. It is so inhuman that if Christ comes to you, you will not be able to recognize him. You will not be able to get the measles even from the Christ. And Buddhists have created the idea of Buddha so abstract, and they have conditioned their children with that abstract idea, with that inoculation, that even if Buddha comes across, you will not be able to recognize him. So not only that a Christian will not be able to recognize Buddha, Mahavira, Patanjali, he will not be even able to recognize Christ. There is a beautiful story in one of Dostoevsky's novels, Brothers Karamazov. After 1800 years, Christ thought, now almost half the world is Christian. If I go again, I will be welcomed. That time, they had treated very badly. And it was natural because there was not a single Christian. There were only Jews. And they tortured Jesus badly and they killed him. He must have been still thinking about the tortures that he has met. But now he thought that the half of the world is Christian. Half of the world belongs to me. If I go now, then people will simply fall into my feet. They will recognize that Christ has come back and he has fulfilled his promise. So he came. He came in the small town of Bethlehem. Must be some old attachment with the town. Some nostalgia of those days where he has played and worked and has been a carpenter. Must have loved women, played with friends. And he was a man who knew how to celebrate. He was a man who knew how to give parties, how to dance and sing, and how to love people. And he was a man who knew how to drink. He had loved small joys of life. He was a real human being. And he used to call himself Son of Man more than he used to call himself Son of God. So he came in Bethlehem. Naturally, he descended in front of the church. Under a tree, he stands there. It is naturally he had chosen Sunday. All the Christians are together, and it will be easier for them to recognize because Christians believe in the Sunday religion. 6 days, they don't bother at all. 6 days, who will look at him? But Sunday, they will be free and they will be able to look at him. So he stands under a tree. People come out of the church. They look at a young man, looks like a hippie. Long hairs. They come around. Seems to be a stranger in the town. The more closer they come, the more they are surprised. Looks like Jesus Christ, pretending well. Seems to be an actor. And they laughed and they said, "You did well, but escape before the priest comes out. Otherwise, you are bound to get into trouble." But Jesus says, "What do you mean, did well? I am Jesus Christ." And they laugh and they said, "It is okay, but you just escape. You seem to be crazy. Jesus Christ and you?" Yes, he has promised to come. But he will come sitting on the clouds, angels dancing and singing around. Where are the angels and where is the cloud? And what proof you have got? Proof? A passport, a visa. Have you got any certificate from your father? Jesus had not thought about these practical things. He looked a little uneasy and nervous. And before he could escape, came the high priest. People very, very respectfully gave the way to the high priest. The high priest came. He looked at this young man and told him to come down. He was standing under the tree on a platform. Come down, you fool. What are you doing here? And he said, even you cannot recognize me. And the priest said, I recognize you very well. And he told to few people, church attendants, take this man into the church. Seems to be dangerous, this man, pretending that he is a Jesus Christ. This is sacrilege. This cannot be tolerated. This man has to be punished. You cannot take Jesus so non-seriously. Jesus could not believe. He says, but I am the real one. And the priest says, you keep quiet. He had been chained, put into a dark cell in the church. He starts thinking and brooding that there seems to be no difference at all. This is the same way Jews had done. But they could have been forgiven because they did not know me. But my people, Christians, they sing to me every day, they think of me every day, they wait for me every day, and I have come and they can't even recognize. They think I am a pretender. Now he feels even more sorry than he had felt on the cross, because those were aligned people. If they had killed him, it was understood. But are these people going to kill me again? And in the middle of the night, he could not sleep. In the middle of the night comes the priest with a candle, opens the door, locks again, comes close to Jesus, falls in the feet of Jesus, and Jesus feels relieved that, so, nothing to be worried. A little late, but he has recognized. And the priest says, I know who you are, but I cannot recognize you in the marketplace. And, mind you are not needed at all. We are doing perfectly well. And you are the old disturbers. If you come, you will destroy everything that we have done in 1800 years. It has been a long struggle to establish Christianity. And you have always been against establishment. You are not establishment. We will pray to you. We will sing your name. We will praise you like anything. But please don't come. And if you insist to be recognized in the marketplace, then be ready. Tomorrow morning you will be crucified. We cannot tolerate such things. Now Jesus is even more puzzled. This man recognizes. He says, I know that you are the truth, but I cannot recognize. And the old priest says, listen to me, I am old, older than you. I am more experienced. I know how people live. I know how people behave. You don't try to be foolish again. You simply escape before the morning and never come back again. This is a beautiful parable. Yes, I know you are inoculated. That's how it is so difficult to catch the measles I'm carrying here. It is so difficult to drop down your resistance. You find 1001 rationalizations how not to surrender. Surrender does not mean anything else. It simply means a state of no resistance, a state of vulnerability, a state of opening. And let me repeat, God cannot be taught, it can only be caught. God is like measles. You ask, when I was a child, I was inoculated against the measles. Everybody has been inoculated. The society takes every care to make you closed. That's why the work of a master is so hard. To attain to God is not hard. But because of this inoculation, first the inoculation has to be undone, and that is the real hard thing. The poison that has been put into you in the name of inoculation has to be driven out of your system. That's why so many techniques are needed, meditations are needed, so that the poison oozes out of your system. The day your system is free of inoculation, suddenly you find the measles have started happening. And blessed are those who can get these measles. The fourth question, I would like to be a world teacher. The second Tirthankara of the tradition of the moon. Is it possible to expose this desire to the public? First, if you really want to be a teacher, become a disciple. Unless you are a really deep disciple, you will not be able to become a teacher. If your disciplehood is perfect, one day suddenly you will find the perfect master has arisen in you. It comes only out of disciplehood. But disciplehood is difficult, because the ego has to be dropped. Everybody would like to become a world teacher. It seems so beautiful. It seems such a beautiful ego trip. Who will not enjoy to be in such a position where he can teach, where he can guide? But where you are going to guide people? You are in the ditch. Resist the temptation. Otherwise, it happens that the blind people start leading the blind people. And they all fall into the dark ditch. Yes, people are in need of guidance. So if you start exposing your desire to the public, you are bound to find disciples. There is no lack of disciples. If you expose yourself that you are the world teacher, you will find suddenly that disciples have started to come. And their coming will help you to feel that maybe it seems you are really the world teacher. Otherwise, why people are coming? How can people be so foolish? By and by, looking into their eyes, feeling their confidence in you, you will start feeling confident about yourself. I have heard about a man, of course a Jew, who opened the first bank in the world. And he became very rich. And the business was beautiful. When he became very old, somebody asked him, How in the first place you started a bank? Nobody had ever heard about it before. He said, I just tried an idea. I wrote the name bank and put the sign on my door. I had no trust in it that it will work. But I had nothing to do. I was unemployed. So I thought, why not try? And within a few hours, a man came and deposited his money. I was surprised. I looked at the man. I thought, this seems to be the greatest fool in the town. I may escape with his money. Then came another and another, and by the evening I had deposited a lot of money. And looking into these people's eyes, I became so confident that I deposited my own money in the bank. That's how it works. If you just declare that you are a world teacher, you are bound to find disciples. And when the disciples will come, certainly you have to be truly a world teacher. I have heard. And sometimes it will happen that not only disciples will come, but something will start happening to the disciples. Then you will be really surprised. Somebody's kundalini arising. Somebody seeing visions. Just by touching your feet, somebody feeling great silence. It happens. Ramakrishna loved this story very much. There was a master, his name was Tapobana. And Tapobana had a disciple who served him with irreproachable diligence. It was solely because of this diligence and the services he rendered that Tapobana kept him. For he found the disciple rather stupid. One day the rumor spread throughout the whole region that Tapobana's disciple had walked on water, that he had been seen crossing the river as one crosses the street. Tapobana called his disciple and questioned him, "Is what people are saying about you possible? Is it really true that you crossed the river walking on the water?" "What could be more natural?" answered his follower. "It is thanks to you, blessed one, that I walked on water. At every step I repeated your saintly name, and that is what upheld me." And Tapovana thought to himself, if the disciple can walk on water, what can the master not do? If it is in my name that the miracle takes place, I must possess power I did not suspect and holiness of which I have not been sufficiently aware. After all, I have never tried to cross the river as if I were crossing the street. And without more ado, he ran to the river bank without hesitation. He set his foot on the water and with unshakable faith repeated, "Me, me, me," and sank. So you are carrying a very dangerous desire. The question is from Prem Prabhu. I know you. The first thing that you have to do is to learn the secrets of disciplehood. Then one day, the master will be born. It is on the way. But don't be in a hurry. Otherwise you will miss being a master. If you try to become a master, you will miss being a master. The mastership arises only when you learn slowly, slowly to dissolve into existence. The day you are not you will be the master, not before it. If you are, then still some work has to be done. You cannot be the master. Only when you are absent, the master becomes present in you. Right now, it will be good if you take a bath. To explain to you, let me tell you this anecdote. A sweet old lady visited a doctor and surprised him by saying, "Doctor, I think I am pregnant and want you to verify it." It was obvious to the doctor, because of her advanced age, that she was imagining things. But he spoke to her kindly, "What makes you think you are pregnant?" I know it because I feel life," she said as she patted her stomach. To humor her all along, the doctor asked her to disrobe. After a brief examination, he advised her to go home and take a bath and forget about the pregnancy. "But doctor," she insisted, "I tell you I feel life, and you tell me to go home and take a bath? And I am feeling life." And she again patted her stomach. "Yes, yes," said the doctor gently, "you have got a bug in your navel. So go and take a bath." The fifth question: why am I the way I am? I feel like the lotus who wants to be the rose. So what is the trouble? So you are the lotus who wants to be the rose, and be it. Whatever you are, you are. And it has to be accepted in absolute humility. Even if you are feeling that you are a lotus and you want to be the rose, so you are the lotus who wants to be the rose. What is, and what ain't. Relax into it, accept it, welcome it. And suddenly you will see a great peace surrounding you, and a great silence arising in you, and a great joy overflowing you. We are missing joy because we are always trying to be something else. Now, I can understand your question. I have been telling you, don't try to be something else. And I had told you, a lotus is a lotus, and a rose is a rose, and the lotus should not try to be a rose, and the rose should not try to be a lotus, otherwise they will go neurotic. That's why you have asked the question. So you ask, "I feel like the lotus who wants to be the rose." So you are thinking you have asked a very relevant question, and I can understand why that way. But listen to my answer. So you are the lotus who wants to be the rose. So be it. That's what I mean, that don't try to be anything else. If this is you, then this is you. No, you would like to try to remain the lotus and not to be the rose. But if that is coming natural to you, you will create a tension in you. Whatsoever comes naturally is good. Whatsoever comes on its own accord is good. The question is from Santi Sagar, and I can see the possibility of his deep acceptance of the fact. Accept it. If this is the way God wants you to be, then be this way. Then this is your destiny. Once you start accepting things, tensions disappear, anxieties fall, anguish is felt no more. And to be in a state of no anguish, no anxiety, no tension, is to be religious. The sixth question, no effort is required to be born. No effort is required to die. No effort is required to fall in love. Why is such effort required to know God? Through meditation, when this seems to be the most natural thing, is God trying to test us in some way? First thing, no effort is required in meditation either. Meditation also comes on its own accord. By effort it never comes. To whom meditation has happened by effort? It will be almost like making an effort to love somebody. How can you make any effort to love somebody? The more effort you make, the more the love will be false, pseudo, just a pretension. Love has to arise naturally. So arises meditation. But all meditators are not spontaneously in it. And neither are all lovers spontaneously in it. In fact, psychologists say a tremendous discovery that if love is not talked about, 99% people will never know anything about it. If love is not talked about, if poets don't go on praising it, and if traditionally literature is not available about love, 99% people will never be aware that anything like love exists. They will know about sex but not about love. But because of the poets and because of the novelists and because of the films and the TV, so much love is talked about that everybody starts thinking that he is in love. That love is also false. And same is the case with meditation. 99% people start meditating because meditation is talked about. There are times when it becomes fashionable. America is passing through such a phase. Meditation is talked about. Everybody is doing meditation. If you are not doing, you must be missing something. You don't feel any need for it. It has not arisen in your being. You have not come to that point of evolution where meditation happens on its own accord. But everybody is doing. And everybody is going to the masters, and everybody is sitting silently. Somebody is doing Zazen, and somebody is doing TM, and somebody is doing dynamic. You must be missing something. So greed arises. Out of greed you start making effort. That effort is not for meditation. That effort is to gain something which you think will be gained out of meditation. These phases come and go. These cults arise and disappear. These are just like fashions. The real meditator has not come to meditate because others are meditating, but a deep need has arisen in him. has become a knocking in his heart, a continuous knocking. The whole world seems to be meaningless. He wants to go in. He wants to know who he is, not because others have known. If there are nobody propagating meditation and no books are available and all books are destroyed and all masters go and hide in the caves in the Himalayas, then too there will be few people who will meditate, who will find how to meditate on their own accord. Those will be the real meditators. And for them meditation will be just as easy as anything. It will be just like breathing. When such a man comes, then any technique functions for him. I observe every day, if somebody whose time has come to meditate, it is just like sexual maturity. A boy of 3 years has no idea about sex. And even if the boy of 3 years comes to see a man making love to a woman, he will not understand what is happening. At the most, he will think the man is trying to kill the woman. They are fighting or something. He will not have any idea what is happening. By the age when he is 14, suddenly something explodes in his biology. He is not aware what it is, but something is happening. He is no more the same. And then follows a time, a period of very much embarrassment, because the boy does not know what exactly is happening, but something is happening. Something very much unknown. Something which is creating trouble. Something which is hovering around. And he does not know what it is and how to tackle with it and how to figure it out. It is a natural phenomenon. Now the sex has become mature. The sex gland is secreting. Almost if life goes naturally, beautifully, if there are no life negative teachers, if there are no politicians and priests to distract you, then near about the age 42, exactly as sex maturity comes, comes meditation maturity. Near about the age 42, one starts feeling to fall within words. Near the age 14, one starts falling towards the others, becomes extrovert. Love is extroversion. Relationship is to think of the others. Meditation is introversion. Meditation is to think of one's own self, of one's own center. Between the 14 and the 42, there comes a change. By and by, one lives the life, knows what love is, knows its fulfillment and its frustration, knows its joy and its sadness, knows its beauty and its ugliness, knows that there are moments of great ecstasy and then great valleys of darkness. Then one starts by and by moving towards his own self. Because to depend on the others can never be really ecstatic. If your joy depends on the others, that joy can never have the quality of freedom in it. And a joy which has not the quality of freedom is not much joy. If you are dependent on the others, then there is a limitation. And the joy that comes through love is momentary. You can meet with the other only for moments. And then again you are separate. And you fall apart. Just in the middle of it, you fall apart. Just for a moment, you become joined together. Then one starts thinking, is there a way to become one with existence and never to fall apart again? That's what meditation is. Love is joining through another person with existence for moments only. Meditation is getting joined together with existence eternally. Yoga means to join together. This has to be somewhere in the deepest core to happen. And then there is joy, and then there is freedom, and then there is bliss, and there is no dark valley following it. Then happiness is eternal. Then celebration is eternal. But that moment comes. That too comes, remember. So you ask, no effort is required to be born, no effort is required to die, no effort is required to fall in love. I would like to tell you, no effort is required to fall in meditation either. But if there are hindrances, for example, in a primitive community, when the child is born, there is no effort, either on the side of the child or on the side of the mother. But that is not the case in a civilized society. Effort is needed. The doctor's help is needed. Much effort is needed to help the child to be born. And the mother feels so much pain. And you don't know how much pain the child feels. If you want to know, you can ask the primal therapist how much trauma he passes through. That small tube, the small passage from the mother's womb to the world is very painful. And the child wants to get out of it. And he thrusts hard to get out of it. And the mother feels painful because the passage is small and the child is big. And she wants to hold unconsciously. She cannot hold. In the nature of things, the child has to come out. But there is a struggle. The mother and the child conflict has started. The child wants to get out and the mother is afraid. And she is holding. She is controlling. This is true about the civilized person, not true about the uncivilized. The uncivilized mother simply goes with it. And the uncivilized person has no need for primal therapy because he never passes through any trauma. The mother is helpful. The child simply floats and comes out. In fact, you will be surprised to know that primitive women know such pleasure and ecstasy in childbirth, that the ecstasy that comes through sexual orgasm is nothing compared to it. What is the ecstasy in sexual orgasm? A man thrusting into the woman and her sexual energies start becoming vibrated, start becoming stirred. That is her sexual orgasm. That pulsation spreads all over the body. But it cannot be compared with the child thrusting and starting coming out. It is the same passage. And the child is far bigger than any male organ. Naturally, the whole being pulsates. And the body goes through a great orgasm. But only a primitive woman knows that it is great ecstasy to give birth to a child. It is not painful at all. It is joy. But it is natural, then it is joy. You say no effort is required to be born? Not for the civilized The civilized person needs much effort to be born. Maybe the mother has been given tranquilizers, sedatives. She has been put into unconsciousness, so she does not pass through great pain. Or even the birth may be the birth of a caesarean. The mother may have to be operated. The doctor is needed, the nurse is needed, the midwife is needed. Why? To undo the wrong that the society has done. You say no effort is required to die, you are again wrong. You can go and see in the American hospitals. Many old people are ready to die and they want to die. They are not allowed to die. The question of euthanasia has become one of the most important questions for the future. Because the medical science has really evolved and it can help a person to live for 200 years or even more. He may not have much of a life, but he can hang. He can hang in a hospital. He will not be able to move or to talk or to love. But he can be just there vegetating. It will be tremendous misery and hell. Now, if he wants to die, no society allows him to die. They say it is illegal. You cannot commit suicide. A person who has become 130 or 140 years of age wants to die because his existence is simply torture. The society seems to be very sadist. They say you are not allowed to die. You will have to live. And the doctors will continue to help you to live because they have much compassion on you. Because of the compassion, you will have to live. Now his wife is dead. His children are dead. His relations are dead. His friends are gone. And he is hanging. For no purpose. He does not know what is going to happen tomorrow, just hanging and hanging and hanging. Can you think the misery that he will feel? And then there will be need to commit suicide. He will have to find ways and means. Maybe he will have to bribe the doctor to cut the connection from the oxygen tank. Are not to give me any more medicines. He may have to bribe. Effort will be needed. Natural death is natural, but man is not natural anymore. So nothing is natural, not even death. If you naturally die, that will be a totally different thing. But you don't live naturally, how can you die naturally? Death has to be the culmination of whatsoever you have done in your life. If you have lived unnaturally, you will die unnaturally. A natural death is possible only if the life has been natural. So the questioner asks, no effort is required to die. You are true. In a very primitive society, no effort is required. But because of the compassion of the missionaries, primitives have disappeared. They are all become educated people now. Now effort is needed to die. Why so many people commit suicide? And the suicide rate goes on growing every year. Why? Is not natural death enough? Suicide means death with effort. And the suicide rate will go higher and higher if the governments are too adamant to relax and they don't allow people to die and they force them into nurseries and into hospitals and force them to live against their wishes, then more and more suicides will be there. Man has disturbed all that is natural. And you say no effort is required to fall in love? That too is not true. That too is not true. Looking at the TV continuously, looking and watching the films, reading the poetries and the novels, they all help you to fall in love. They give you the idea. They nourish your so-called love. It is not natural. Natural has disappeared. All that is nature has disappeared. Everything is false and plastic. Hence, meditation has also to be false and plastic. But real meditation never happens by effort. Then what one has to do? You have to do some effort in the beginning. Otherwise, you will never come close to any meditation technique, close to any meditation school. You will have to go through effort because you have become unnatural beings. Making effort will help you to understand what meditation is. It will not lead you into meditation. It will simply help you to understand what meditation is. It will help you to understand whether you can fall into that space called meditation easily or not. If you feel that it comes very easily to you, you can fall in that space and you can reach that space, effort will disappear by itself. There will be no need. You can simply sit with closed eyes and it is there. It is so natural. But once it happens, it is very natural. And unless it has happened, you will not be able to know whether you are a natural meditator or not. So effort will be needed. Man has been made so artificial that everything will have to be made through effort. But by making effort, you will come to feel and see whether you can easily float into it or not. And you ask, why is such effort required to know God when this seems to be the most natural thing? If it is the most natural thing, then it must have happened to the questioner. It has not happened. Otherwise you will not be here. What a God-realized man is doing here. There is no point. Your seeking has stopped if you have known. Yes, once you know, it is very simple and easy. But until you know it, effort will be needed. And remember, effort is not needed for meditation. Effort is needed to undo what the society has done to you. A de-hypnosis is needed. The society has hypnotized you. The society has conditioned you, and unconditioning is needed. The society has made you dirty. A cleansing is needed. A good shower. That's what your effort is. Once you have started feeling that meditation is your innermost quality, you can go into it any time. It is so easy as breathing. Then all effort disappears. And you ask, is God trying to test us in some way? No. There is no God in the first place to test you. And even if there is a God, He is not in any way interested in testing and examining you. What is the point? And He is not a sadist to torture you. Teachers are sadists. Examiners are sadists. You can ask the psychologists. They say people who want to torture others, they become teachers. Some tendency to torture. And you cannot find more beautiful opportunities than small children. Torture them, test them, examine them. And for their own good. And nobody can prevent you because you are doing for their own good. God is not in any way interested in testing you. The problem is not arising because of God. The problem is arising because of your society, your politics, your priesthood. They have made you in such a way that you cannot meditate. They have made such simple things impossible. It is just like in the ancient days in China, they used to put small shoes, iron shoes, on women's feet. Because that was the sign. A smaller feet was the sign that the woman comes from a royal family. If the woman cannot walk rightly, she was royal. So no rich women were able to walk. They had small feet. And if you encage the feet in an iron shoe, what are you doing? Great pain was suffered just to have a small feet. Those feet cannot be beautiful. Those feet are ugly because the growth has not happened. How can something retarded be beautiful? But that was thought for thousands of years beautiful, and women suffered it, and they enjoyed it that they have small feet. Now that has disappeared. Now, if a royal woman, a rich woman in ancient China, was to learn running, jogging, it would have been very difficult. Much effort would have been needed because she had not the feet. Not that God is testing her. Just because the society is foolish and the society has conditioned her feet in such a way that she cannot run. And the same is true about 1001 things. Your society conditions you in a certain way, then you cannot do certain things. When you want to do them, much effort is needed to undo what the society has done. The society has taught you to think, and to think continuously, and to think skillfully and cleverly. It has not allowed you to know that there are spaces of no thought. Because the society is afraid, those spaces of no thought are very dangerous. Those spaces of no thought are very crazy. Those spaces of no thought will give you great joy, but will make you so rebellious. Those great spaces will make you very, very happy, but a happy person becomes free. He cannot be easily enforced to do foolish things. You cannot send him to the army. He will say, nonsense. I am so happy, why I should go and kill other and be killed? You cannot send him to the military. He will simply say no. You cannot force him to do foolish things for his whole life like a machine. He will say, why? I will do things that I like and that I love. A ecstatic person is a rebellion in the world. You cannot tell him to just be a clerk in an office and go on filing things, putting files upon file, whole his life. He will say, I will go and become a farmer because I love trees. If I am not going to be rich, it is okay. My richness will be of the inner. I am going to become a fisherman. I will be on the open sea. I don't want to become a clerk.